From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Mateo.
San Francisco, Mission Dolores Park.
Financial District near the Tenderloin.
San Bruno.
North Sunnyvale.
Downtown Palo Alto, my beloved.
Redwood City.
Coming up, what makes us want to be good?
Compassion is complex.
It's not quite an emotion, is it? It's like more sophisticated. It might involve emotion.
Emerging science is exploring how we connect with others.
Can we see it? Does it help people to extend compassion? That would be very exciting because it's for scientists, that's a whole new toolkit.
We'll look into the history of how we study human nature, and we'll see how we can be better.
Fundamentally, at the end of the day, we are wired for this. It makes us feel better. It makes us healthier.
Today, from KALW News, it's the original documentary, A Three-Inch Shift, The Science of Compassion. The news of the world can be depressing. Politics, poverty, war. We live in a seemingly endless cycle of strife, and we often bring it upon ourselves. But there is more to life, the moments where we find something deeper, a relationship, a purpose, a connection. Compassion, it turns out, can be cultivated. There's a science to it, and one of the centers of study is here in the Bay Area. Today, we're exploring what makes us care through personal stories, new technologies, and cross-cultural relationships. KALW presents A Three-Inch Shift, The Science of Compassion, an original documentary by Judy Silber.
When Ken Ingram was about 5 years old, the arguing with his father began.
So he calls me in the room and he says, Ken, what color is your mom? So this is like 68 and the civil rights thing is big. And I said, well, she's white.
Actually, his mother is a fair-skinned black woman. At five, Ken didn't understand the difference.
Because to my mind, black was dark, white was light. There wasn't a degree. And so he's placing this political distinction upon me at a five-year-old, and I just turned in this big argument that drove me nuts. And I think that set the tenor of my relationship with him from that point on.
Years passed. Tension. Confrontation. Ken went to high school, and the conflicts escalated.
And he had this habit. He would throw me on the ground and put his foot on my throat. It was just is incredibly insulting. But I would suck it up, and one day, he grabbed me by the throat, and had these cinder blocks, the makeshift cinder block bookshelf. And one of them was just sitting there. And I considered grabbing it and cracking him on the head, and I knew I wouldn't stop if I started. I remember the moment because I remember the emotion and the feeling. I remember looking him in the eye, and it was just this hot, hot rage. And then the moment I went into kill mode, everything went cold. It was utterly cold.
In the next moment, Ken saw where he was headed. Prison and a wasted life behind bars. Out of self-preservation, he stopped. He left the cinder block on the floor. The next day, he signed up for the Marines. It got him out of the house, away from his father. But after 2 years as a soldier, he again wrestled with his destiny. In his mind, it went like this. He could become a career military officer and kill for a living, or he could try and find a less violent, more enlightened path. He finished his 4-year tour of duty and went back to civilian life. Sometime later, he looked up the meaning of compassion.
I realized I didn't really understand what the word meant, so I went and looked it up in the dictionary.
Compassion, noun, sympathetic consciousness of others' distress, together with a desire to alleviate it.
In reading the word, there was just this spark of understanding, and I'm like, oh.
If we look at the roots, passion means to endure, to suffer. So compassion is to suffer with. Religions throughout the world speak about compassion, but the 14th Dalai Lama of Tibet is especially outspoken.
Now, you should think. How to bring this century, more peaceful century, more compassionate century?
If you look at all of his messages and all of his central teachings, they go into the Mahayana concept of compassion and great compassion.
Martin Verhoeven is a Berkeley-based Buddhist scholar and teacher.
And this is called Tung Ti Da Be, single substance great compassion. It means the wisdom insight to see that we are all interconnected, all interrelated, and therefore that's the reality.
Tibetan Buddhism is filled with mystical images and occult traditions. But the Dalai Lama says compassion is a human trait, innate to who we are. Here he is speaking at Stanford University in 2010.
In reality, I think no longer the concept of we and they. Entire now nearly 7 billion human beings should consider part of we. Because individual future depend on them. So from one's own sort of interest, you have to think whole planet, whole humanity. So that's a reality.
For our own self-interest, we have to think about the whole planet, he says, all of humanity. Here in the West, we take pride in individualism, self-reliance. But compassion is more about interdependence than independence, connection rather than separation.
Compassion is a meta concept that has elements of empathy, of sensitivity, of kindness, of tolerance built into it. All are sort of, if you're looking at a kaleidoscope, little pieces of it.
Compassion is complex. There is this empathic part. There is this reappraisal part. There is this caring, nurturing part.
It's not quite an emotion, is it? It's like more sophisticated. It might involve emotion, but then it involves the other components, like taking another's viewpoint maybe, and, you know, thinking about how they might be in the future. They might be different. They might be relieved of suffering.
That compassion is an embodied process. It's not a disincarnate process. And that through that experience of grounding, we're actually able to perceive suffering.
It's a moral imperative. It's sort of something you should do. No. It's part of what is driving the whole show. And you're naturally inclined to do it under certain circumstances.
Why wouldn't we want to promote this and make people understand that this type of action has a positive effect?
There's a question on James Doty's mind.
And it always interested me why people behave the way they behave.
Doty is a neurosurgeon and the director and founder of C-Care, a center for compassion research and training, started in 2009 at Stanford.
I grew up in poverty. My mother was an invalid and my father was an alcoholic. And we were on public assistance essentially my entire life.
So he noticed when people did or did not offer help.
I would see people who, even as a child, clearly were in a position where they could be very helpful and kind, yet chose not to. Yet you would see people who were potentially even in more desperate straits than yourself, yet who would reach out to you and be very kind. And this paradox always struck me.
In November 2005, the Dalai Lama came to campus. He met some of the world's top scientists in a public forum.
First of all, I would like to extend my greetings to this eminent and famous University of Stanford for hosting this dialogue between Buddhist contemplative tradition and science.
At the time, Bill Mobley was director of Stanford's Neuroscience Institute.
And the question for today is simply this. Can neuroscientists, with their tools and concepts, bring to Buddhists, with their wonderful contemplative practices, something special, and vice versa? And can the two of them together be more effective in understanding brain and mind? Now, why would they want to work together?
A lifelong science fan, the Dalai Lama pushed for collaboration.
Doubt brings question. Question brings investigation. Investigation brings satisfactory, I think, understanding or awareness about the reality.
James Doty wasn't there. He had taken a leave from Stanford for a few years. But hearing about the Dalai Lama's visit made an impression.
And I knew nothing about this field, other than I knew that clearly the brain is what is the ultimate driver.
He thought back on his own life.
And I just wanted to understand, how can we study these drivers, and are there ways that we can create techniques that make people more kind?
Now, Dodi is a doctor, not a scientist, but he's got a certain, well, brashness, a power of persuasion. He has a story about applying for medical school. He was an unlikely candidate, only a 2.53 GPA at UC Irvine. And he needed a recommendation from the school's pre-med committee.
These professors showed up, and as I recall, the head of biological sciences was there. You could see that they were not particularly interested in having a conversation with me. But I had a conversation with them, and my conversation was who gave them the right to decide people's futures? And where was the evidence that beyond a minimal academic performance that having a higher GPA had any correlation with whether you were a good doctor, you cared about people?
Dodi tears up as he remembers.
This conversation went on for about an hour with primarily me talking. And at the end of it, they were actually crying. So what happened was that I ended up getting the highest recommendation they could give.
Dodi is emotional recalling the story because he went on to become a neurosurgeon. He helped fund a medical device company, eventually became its CEO, made millions as an angel investor, only to lose most of it in the stock market crash of 2000. This made him reflective. In 2007, when he returned to Stanford, Dodi began talking with Stanford scientists about how to research compassion. By 2008, he stood before the Dalai Lama. Dodi explained his idea.
To really try to understand in a rigorous way, utilizing the tools of neuroscience and psychology, this complex behavior we call compassion and altruism, and see if there were ways we could cultivate it in people, because my own feeling was that this would improve people's lives and the lives of those affected by people who were being kind to them.
The Dalai Lama listened and then began talking excitedly with his translator, Tupten Jinpa, in Tibetan.
Jinpa turned to me and he said, Jim, His Holiness feels so strongly about the importance of this work that you're undertaking, that he wants to make a personal donation, which turned out to be the largest donation he's ever given to a non-Tibetan cause.
$150,000. Two Silicon Valley investors donated another $1 million each. By January 2009, there was enough to start a center at Stanford dedicated to compassion.
You're listening to Judy Silber's radio documentary, A Three-Inch Shift, The Science of Compassion. And this is Cross Currents from KALW News.
Today, the U.S. poverty rate is higher than it's been in 17 years, affecting some 46 million people.
The jobless rate is nearly 25%, and now they'll see lower wages.
Thousands of dollars that I cannot afford. My family is poor.
What would a more compassionate world look like? Would it lead to more understanding and less suspicion of one another?
But, you know, as the parties have become more polarized, that's gotten a little bit harder.
With compassion, would we do better at solving the world's problems of malnutrition, poverty, natural disasters, and disease? Or is that just a fantasy?
Jewish settlers against Palestinians.
And the dark side of human nature is always inevitable.
It's an issue that isn't likely to go away anytime soon.
If you think about it, the establishment of CCARE was quite remarkable. East meeting West on the prestigious grounds of Stanford. Eastern ideas of oneness commingling with Western ideas of science and reason. So how did we get here? One person to ask is a man born to a Roman Catholic family in a Wisconsin town that produced both Joe McCarthy and Harry Houdini.
Martin Verhoeven, number of titles, so I'm adjunct professor of comparative religion at GTU.
The Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley.
Professor of Buddhist classics, Dharmaram Buddhist University, and also a teacher at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery here in Berkeley.
Let's just say he's intellectually inclined. As a young Buddhist monk in the 70s, Verhoeven traveled widely in Asia. The culture was completely new to him.
I was kind of shocked by what I encountered.
Buddhism, he discovered, was not one entity, but many. From country to country, and even region to region, it changed.
There were Buddhisms. There wasn't a Buddhism.
He realized that as the religion migrated from its birthplace of India into other parts of Asia, there was a two-way impact. Buddhism on the culture, and the culture on Buddhism.
So I began to think, well, what is going to happen or what's happening as that comes into Europe and America? What's going to be the mix? What's going to happen as they encounter each other?
The roots of that encounter, Verhoeven says, go back to Charles Darwin.
And if you want to trace it historically, you see the interest in Buddhism almost goes directly proportional to the crisis of faith that Westerners were experiencing with their traditional religious systems.
In 1859, Darwin published The Origin of Species. The new theory of evolution called into question fundamental Judeo-Christian beliefs.
The idea that suddenly this Bible that they had been reading literally might not be literal truth.
It seemed science was questioning the very existence of God. And if God did not exist, then for many, religion no longer had a place. This was a problem, a big problem. In 1893, the World Parliament of Religions met in Chicago. It was a pivotal moment. Eastern leaders pitched Buddhism as the religion that could handle the growing split between science and faith. In the years that followed, a reverse missionary movement took place. Charismatic Eastern teachers came to the U.S. and artfully shaped their message for American consumption.
Buddhism was, quote, as American as apple pie, in the sense that it wasn't incompatible with Judeo-Christian thought, and in fact it was a transcendence or a growth beyond and above that.
As new scientific discoveries were made, Buddhist leaders continued to press the point
that it did not have the conflict between religion and science that the Western world was experiencing, and that they could be deeply spiritual and scientific and rational at the same time. They didn't have to choose.
And so it grew in the West. Now, of course, other cultural and historical factors influenced Buddhism's entry into mainstream American culture. Immigration, the translation of Buddhist scriptures, the arts. In the 1950s, alienated by post-war America, Bay Area beat poets Gary Snyder, Jack Kerouac, and Allen Ginsberg incorporated Buddhist teachings into their writing.
Oh, and Kerouac, Jack still jumps with the same beat genius as before, notebooks filled with Buddha.
Philosopher Alan Watts helped break more ground with his books and popular KPFA radio addresses.
Everybody can be a Buddha. Everybody has in himself the capacity to wake up.
In the decades that followed, more and more Americans looked to Buddhism as a spiritual guide. Today, the dialogue about science and faith continues. At this point in time, science is our holder of truth. And so the spread of Buddhism is not necessarily religious. The mindfulness aspects of it, the development of consciousness and compassion, they can be separated. They can be secular. Verhoeven says many Buddhist teachers, especially the Dalai Lama, understand this.
He's just being, in a sense, pragmatic and saying, look, most Westerners make sense of things through science. So let's have the discourse here. This is very upaya, in meaning skillful means. You don't want to talk about mysticism or, you know, to Westerners at this point, you don't want to talk about ghosts and spirits. That might be a discourse for another culture, but not for the United States. So science becomes the one.
Stanford neuroscientist Brian Knutson and I are peering through a window. On the other side is a futuristic, large, white, bleeping machine with a person's leg sticking out. It's called a fMRI machine, where fMRI stands for Functional Magnetic Resonance Imaging. It costs $500 an hour to use, and Knutson depends on it. Instead of just asking subjects, do you feel compassionate? He can look
deep in your brain on a second-to-second basis. You know, we didn't have those kinds of measures over a decade ago. And now that we have functional magnetic resonance imaging, we can actually ask those questions.
Knutson's lab is one of about 15 groups to receive money from CCARE, Stanford Center for Compassion.
Yes, so we've been funded by CCARE on campus, who is interested in compassion research, to do a little pilot study where we try to combine compassion research with brain imaging, which is not easy. It's a very new area. A lot of people are getting interested in this, but there are a lot of questions about how do you measure this, how do you elicit it, and so forth.
All of this puts Knutson and Stanford on the cutting edge. Researchers have been studying the benefits of mindfulness meditation for a while now, but compassion research is brand new. Their peers include the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, along with other researchers around the country. Knutson didn't set out to study compassion. He resisted when CCARE founder James Doty first approached him.
Well, I was thinking that I'm not really the right one to do the research, and that I know other people who are much better than me at this kind of thing.
Before heading up a laboratory of his own, Knutson studied under Paul Ekman, a famous emotion researcher. Like Ekman, Knutson is interested in emotions' influence on how we act. And like Doty, he believes science has something to learn from Buddhism about this. So when Doty persisted, Knutson finally agreed.
If we can look in the brain, we'll say, well, okay, so the Buddhists say these components are going into compassion. And we think those components may map onto something that's happening in the brain. Do they? Can we see it? Does it help people to extend compassion? That would be very exciting because it's for scientists, that's a whole new toolkit, right? So we're in the magnet facility now. You can hear the magnet in the background. Typically, what we'll do is train a subject in this chamber. And then they'll go into that chamber after they've taken their shoes off. And they'll lie on the gurney and we'll slide them in the magnet.
Knutson and his colleagues recruited Stanford undergrads. In the basement of Stanford's psychology department, they put them inside an fMRI machine.
And they can actually see through a mirror a large screen at the back of the magnet, which shows the experimental stimuli. And they can respond with button presses on a little button box that's on their chest as they're lying down throughout the experiment.
They showed each undergrad photos of neutral faces. That is, people with neutral expressions. Half of the time, they asked the undergrads to stay neutral. In the other half, they asked the students to offer up compassion.
And then the face comes on the screen, and you can see that that woman is neutral. And you basically have 6 seconds to do this. So it's not a lot of time.
6 seconds to either stay neutral or conjure up some feeling of compassion for people you've never met and whom you don't know anything about.
Identifying with another person, feeling their suffering, wishing them to be free of their suffering. Like those three components are understandable by non-Buddhists, even, you know, students at our university here.
Understandable, But Knudsen didn't know if the undergrads could do it. After all, they're not monks who train day in, day out to feel compassion for all beings. But when asked to extend compassion, the undergrads said they did. And Knudsen says it turns out they were right.
So that's pretty amazing to us.
Here's how they figured it out. There are three steps to this. One, they showed the neutral faces. Two, they showed a second set of pictures, paintings of abstract art. Three, just before showing the abstract art, the experimenters quickly flashed a neutral face, one of the same faces to which the undergrads had previously either stayed neutral or extended compassion to. The researchers did this quickly, subliminally, so the undergrads wouldn't notice. Then they asked, on a scale of 1 to 4, how did this painting make you feel?
So if there's a systematic bias, right, then that's gonna show up basically in how you rate the art that comes afterwards.
In other words, the undergrads rated paintings higher if they felt compassion first.
And what these results suggest to us, even though they're very preliminary and on a small sample, is that even in, you know, unschooled undergrads who are not spending 30,000 hours in a cave, you know, doing compassion meditation, they can do this and there can be effects that carry over.
Now, this is unpublished data. It's not yet vetted by the larger scientific community. But if it holds up, Knudsen can continue using this setup as a measure for compassion. He's also analyzing the fMRI scans to see which part of the brain light up while subjects feel compassion. In addition, Knudsen is screening people he calls the Super Olympians of compassion, people who have completed a secluded meditation retreat that lasts a total of 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days. He plans to compare their brain patterns with those of the undergrads. Are their brains different? If so, that might give a hint for how the rest of us can do better, to develop our capacity for compassion. It's not science for science's sake. It's science to help make the world a better place.
You're listening to Judy Silber's radio documentary, A Three-Inch Shift, The Science of Compassion. This is Cross Currents from KALW News.
Obviously, human nature is complex. But to simplify, there's good and there's bad. Philip Zimbardo is a member of CCARE's board and a professor emeritus at Stanford. He considers himself a good person, but he spent most of his career focused on the forces of evil. He's famous for a study called the Stanford Prison Experiment.
You don't know, I gotta go. To a doctor, anything. I can't say anything. I f***ed up. I don't know how to explain it. I'm f***ed up inside. Help me out!
This sound is from footage documented in a film called Quiet Rage, made by Zimbardo at Stanford. For 1 week in August 1971, he and others took over the basement of Stanford's psychology building. Over an intense 6 days, otherwise well-adjusted college students transformed into helpless prisoners and cruel guards.
Once you take that first step, then
you're smarter to an athlete. You get down here and do 10 push-ups.
Then you're now involved in this downward spiral.
For the college students who volunteered, this was a job. $15 a day for 2 weeks over summer break.
It's 1971. These kids are, many of them, hippies. Everybody has hair down. You know, it's like, you know, Hair, the play Hair came out in 1968. Yeah, many of these kids are anti-war activists. How many of these kids are involved in civil rights? all of these kids are involved in don't trust authority of the 70s.
Compassion wasn't spoken of. The tenor of the time had more to do with mistrust. Against this backdrop, the experiment began. With the coin toss, the prisoners received roles. There were 9 prisoners and 9 guards.
Well, when I first got here, even though there was, I had to strip and go through the process, and they would call me names and made me look in the mirror and see how ridiculous I was and stuff, I still didn't feel at all like I was in the prison. I was just looking at it as a job.
Prisoners were stripped, deloused, and given a smock and stocking cap to wear. During the study, they would not be addressed by name, only by ID numbers.
Prisoner 819 did a bad thing. Prisoner 819 did a bad thing.
The prisoners rebelled.
They barricaded themselves in their cells. They ripped off their numbers. We had sewn Boy Scout numbers. And suddenly the guards come to me and they say, what are we going to do? I said, it's your prison. What do you want to do?
Role-playing had become real.
And they took off the doors and they stripped the prisoners naked. And there was actually some physical, you know, confrontation, which I stopped. But now the guards said, these are dangerous prisoners.
The guards played psychological mind games on the prisoners.
Just intuitively knowing how to create an environment where prisoners began to feel helpless and hopeless.
I had really thought that I was incapable of this kind of behavior. I was surprised, I was dismayed to find out that I could really be a... that I could act in a manner so absolutely unaccustomed to anything I would even really dream of doing.
So essentially, you know, what they did was on their own, and I hadn't even thought about any of that, is to create an environment which was relatively unpredictable, except if you followed the rules, you know, you would not get punished. So that was the most basic thing.
Over the next few days, the cruelty of the guards grew. They shouted obscenities. They made prisoners clean toilets with their bare hands and move boxes endlessly back and forth. Prisoners had to do countless numbers of push-ups and jumping jacks in smocks with no underwear. Bad prisoners were given time in solitary, a small, dark closet.
And what happened is, at this point, I think it's halfway through, I transform from being the principal investigator of the research project, there to observe and collect data, to become the superintendent of the Stanford Prison Experiment.
His main concern was now taking care of the prison, not the students' well-being.
And I saw it when I looked at the videotapes, when I'm walking down a row of prisoners with my hands behind my back, chest out. And this is what military people, this is what, you know, authorities do when they're reviewing the troops. It's a position I never take. I didn't even know who it was on the video.
Day 3. The parents of prisoner 1037, Rich Yako, spoke with Zimbardo.
The mother comes in and says, I don't mean to make trouble, sir, but I've never seen my son looking so terrible. Well, as prison superintendent, that's a red alarm. She's going to make trouble. She says she doesn't mean to want to make trouble. And I said, so I now automatically go into, you know, the administrator's role. I have to make it clear it's not about us, it's about her kid. I say, what seems to be your son's problem? Okay. And she says, well, he's not sleeping. He's up all hours of the night. I said, does he have insomnia? So I'm putting the problem in him. She says, no, the guards wake them up. I said, oh, yes, of course. And every guard shift, they have to see that the prisoners are present and accountable, be sure nobody's escaped and so forth. And I'm giving all this stuff. She says, yeah, but I don't mean to make trouble. So she says it a second time. At this point, double alarm goes off. I said, uh-oh, I have to recruit the husband. I have to do the male thing. And this is unconscious automatic processing. I turn to him and say, Mr. Yako, don't you think your boy can handle it? What is he going to say? He says, of course he can. He's a real leader. Da, da, da. I shake his hand, give him a slap on the back. I say, you know, good to see you. Come back, you know, next visiting hour. Come on, honey. He takes her out. That night, Yako has a breakdown.
On day 4, the guard's sadistic harassment escalated to include sexual humiliation. On the fifth night, Zimbardo invited a few outside faculty and graduate students to the prison to observe. By this point, Zimbardo said, the guards had either become active perpetrators of evil or passive contributors.
I said, oh my God, I have been transformed by the power of the situation. You know, day by day, unconsciously taking on all these roles, all these duties, all these obligations. And I've become, you know, the uncaring, indifferent superintendent of the Stanford Prison Jail.
Zimbardo stopped the experiment, but the repercussions went on for decades. Doug Corpy was the first prisoner to break down in the study. He went on to become a forensic psychologist. Another prisoner, Craig Haney, became a professor at UC Santa Cruz and a leading authority on the psychological effects of incarceration. In the immediate aftermath, Zimbardo testified before Congress about prison issues. 33 years later, in 2004, it came up again when U.S. soldiers abused Iraqi prisoners at the Abu Ghraib prison.
Almost anyone could be seduced into behaving in evil ways. Almost anyone could be a perpetrator of evil. Certainly a majority. That's the conclusion of all the research. People who do evil deeds, except when they're in that situation, are like the rest of us. They don't look different. They don't act different. They look like your Uncle Charlie. They look like your Aunt Minnie. And it's not until we put Eichmann in charge of Auschwitz that he did these terrible things. Everything we know about him before, everything we know about him since, he was normal. In fact, the psychiatrist at his trial in Nuremberg said, he's more normal than I am.
But it wasn't until he started writing a book about the Stanford study that he started to think,
well, what is the flip side of that? Isn't it true that ordinary people in certain situations can be induced, inspired to do heroic deeds rather than evil deeds?
He decided that instead of trying to find villains, he wanted to find heroes.
I mean, a hero is somebody who takes action in defense of a moral cause or helping another person in an emergency situation, aware of the potential costs and risk, and you do it without expectation of gain.
James Doty of CCARE asked him to sit on the Compassion Center's board. The shift from evil to good took Zimbardo nearly 40 years.
The problem is evil is fascinating. Good is boring. You know, so it's so easy. I mean, it's easier to get to like Lucifer than the good angels. You know, the Wicked Witch, you know, is more interesting than, what's it, Glinda, the good witch. So I guess that was the attraction. How do you understand? You see, the other thing, you want to understand evil so you can undo it. You know, good, you want to recognize. But I'm saying, no, good, you want to recognize and use that recognition now to inspire other people so that recognition of goodness in people should be the start of a program to inspire other people to emulate them, to go on a path.
This is Cross Currents from KALW News. You're listening to Judy Silber's radio documentary, A Three-Inch Shift, The Science of Compassion.
One summer when CCARE founder James Doty was about 13, he walked into a magic shop. He started talking with a woman there, the owner's mother.
And her and I started chatting, and she said to me, she said, you know, I like you a lot. If you come here every day for the next 6 weeks, I'll teach you something that will change your life. So I showed up, and she taught me a meditative or mindfulness meditation practice in conjunction with a visualization technique, probably combined to some extent with the power of positive thinking and self-hypnosis. And that interaction completely changed my perspective. It changed my brain, if you will, in the sense that I stopped perceiving myself as a victim, but saw that, in fact, I was responsible for my destiny, and it was I who made the decisions and could control that destiny.
These days, Dodi doesn't meditate, and he doesn't care about Buddhism so much. But he is interested in how its practices can help people become kinder and more compassionate.
Okay, so let's first come to a position that feels, well, let's say relatively centered. So make a conscious choice about the position of your body. And there's anything that feels really tense.
Kelly McGonigal sits cross-legged on top of a lecturer's table at Stanford University.
Begin to notice when you breathe in and when you breathe out. And you might label the breath for a few rounds, saying in your own mind, inhale as you breathe in, and exhale as you breathe out.
The students in this class are mostly middle-aged and up. They're not at Stanford for any kind of degree. Rather, they're here for CCARE's compassion cultivation class. Where scientific research is CCARE's right arm, compassion training is its left.
But let's add to this awareness the sensation of the breath, finding a feeling of the breath somewhere in your body that stands out to you.
CCARE staff worked with the Dalai Lama's interpreter, Thupten Jinpa, to design the 9-week class. Some of the exercises are from Western psychology, but many are from Tibetan Buddhism. Even so, this is a secular class. There's no chanting, no icons, no mention of the Buddha or even Buddhism.
The idea is that you will bring something to mind that embodies or represents the quality of compassion and any related qualities like acceptance, love, support, strength, or wisdom.
Strip away religion and you make way for mainstream adoption. That's the theory anyway. And there's a precedent. A program called MBSR, which stands for Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. It's a secular treatment for pain and anxiety that draws from Buddhist mindfulness practices. Started in the 1970s, it's now institutionalized at hospitals and health centers all over the country. CCARE wants to do the same, but for compassion. Already it's offered the 9-week course at UC Berkeley, Stanford, the Palo Alto Veterans Administration, and Sharp Healthcare in San Diego. With a 1-year teacher training program, the hope is that eventually those students, who come from a variety of backgrounds, including healthcare, education, mental health, and public health, will teach the course in their communities.
So the first type of image that you might bring to mind is a model of compassion, a human being, or a religious figure. Someone who represents the very ideal of compassion, acceptance, warmth. So see if in your own life or in your own faith, there is such a person, such a model.
This week's theme in McGonigal's class is self-compassion. The class started with the basics of mindfulness and will end with a difficult practice called Tonglen, which involves imagining breathing in the world's suffering and breathing love back out. McGonigal says students often come to the course with misguided notions.
Still getting emails, people wanting to argue that could we just exclude suffering from the definition of compassion? Because it would be so much better if we didn't have to have suffering and we could just feel compassion without suffering having to be present.
But compassion demands an acknowledgement that suffering is part of life.
I think people stick it out because if they actually do the practices, you see that there's something there. You have the experience of touching something that is really interesting and also is not our habitual way of relating to the world. And I think seeing that, that having that momentary shift, intrigues people enough to stick around.
I
Deborah DiFilippo, and I've spent my career as an executive in finance in medical devices.
DiFilippo heard about C-Care when she attended a discussion between scientists and the Dalai Lama. Researchers talked about the health benefits of meditation.
I am I'm a type A, high-achieving person, and I'm now catching myself when someone in front of me is driving below the speed limit, saying the phrases that are in almost every single meditation practice that Kelly had. You say, for each individual and yourself and the world, may you be happy, may you be free from pain and suffering, and may you experience joy and peace. And so when I'm in traffic or when someone's driving below the speed limit and I'm feeling that tension come up, I find my mind going into that and saying that for that driver. What happens is that tension of wanting to go faster, it's almost immediate. It's like taking a deep breath, and a lot of calm does instill within me.
Stanford's C-Care program has its critics. Some worry this type of secular practice will lose something and perhaps lack substance. Others say the aspirations of C-Care, to make a more compassionate world, are too idealistic. They question how much students can learn in 9 weeks. But McGonigal says many students do connect what's taught by C-Care with what's occurring in their lives.
One of my favorite stories was a man who was in a church setting, and a homeless woman had approached this group that was meeting at the church. And he could feel in himself that little bit of threat or stress arising that would normally have led him to maybe get rid of that person as quickly as possible so that she didn't disturb the group that was meeting.
The man remembered a lesson from the previous week in class.
That just like him, she was human, that she was suffering. Going down the checklist, does this person need help? Do I have the resources to help? And it turns out that she had diabetes and she needed food, and there wasn't food available in that moment, and the people in the group were able to get her something to eat. And the whole thing ended very differently because he was using this framework from the study that we talked about. So that's very exciting to me to see that people can take something from a study and use it in everyday life.
Which is exactly what C-Care founder James Doty wants.
If we already know that these techniques clearly and demonstrably through science can have an impact on the brain, then why not use them?
C-Care is studying the mind for clues on how to improve our capacity for compassion and to understand its mental and health benefits. It's also teaching courses to cultivate compassion. The goal with all of this is to imprint an attitude of caring.
I would tell people, if I could find a drug that would do this, I would use that too. Or if I found something on the back of a chocolate bar wrapper and it worked, I would use that. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how we get there. My only interest is finding techniques, whatever they are, that can accomplish this goal.
Shifting the way people interact with each other, with the world, can seem impossible. But Doty is the kind of person who thrives with impossible odds.
To promote compassion, kindness, altruism, empathy. Fundamentally, at the end of the day, we are wired for this. It makes us feel better. It makes us healthier. And it will allow our species to survive into the future.
I realized I didn't really understand what the word meant, so I went and looked it up in the dictionary.
Compassion, noun. Sympathetic consciousness of others' distress, together with a desire to alleviate it.
In reading the word, there was just this spark of understanding, and I'm like, oh.
Ken Ingram had a difficult relationship with his father. So difficult, he came close to killing him. To escape the situation, he joined the Marines, served his tour of duty, and went on with his life. Years passed.
Yeah, my dad got really ill. He developed prostate cancer, but when he found out about it, it was in stage 3. Still, at that point, was still really pissed at my father. Really, really pissed. And it was around Labor Day weekend of 2009. The hospice had started taking care of him because he'd started getting really weak. And they called me and my sister and said, you know, we're not going to be able to take care of him over the weekend. So I took over the first night and I stayed all night at his apartment. And as the night wore on, he kept getting weaker. It was evident he was getting weaker because his voice was getting lower and lower in volume. And it was almost in delirium. And at one point, he's like, I can't turn over. Can you help me turn over? And my father, my memory of him physically is he was a strong, strong man. And I had to pick him up and just shift him a little bit in his bed. And it was this moment of picking him up. All I can say is just, it was this spark of knowingness. Like I got him in that moment. Like it had been the closest I'd gotten. And I guess because there was no emotional barriers up for him anymore, he just didn't have the energy for it or even the presence of mind. But that being that close to him physically and having to care for him in that way, it was just a flash of, oh, I get him. And it wasn't something I could put into words. It's just an awareness of, it's just who he is. But in that moment, just I realized, oh, this is what compassion is. That in spite of all the anger and the righteous indignation that I had over things that he had done that weren't so cool, I had this awareness, you know, he did a lot of things that were cool. He took care of me, like in many, many ways. And so compassion was being able to let go of that ego trip that I was on, that I was owed something, that something was done to me, that me. No, this is a human being who helped me come in the world, helped me learn how to be in the world, helped me learn how to survive in the world, and he needs my help. Can I let go of my anger about it and help him? And it was such a small thing. It wasn't like I had to move the world or build a building. It was shift him 3 inches in the bed.
You've been listening to A 3-Inch Shift, The Science of Compassion, an original documentary by Judy Silber, presented by KALW News. We had help from Angela Johnston and Isaac Silk. Cross Currents engineers are Chris Hoff and Seth Samuel. Our senior editor is Casey Miner. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. For KALW News, I'm Ben Trefney.